The plain fact is that a great many Americans are not eating well enough to sustain health.
President Richard Nixon, addressing the White House Conference on Nutrition, December 1969.
A child ill-fed is dulled in curiosity, lower in stamina, distracted from learning. The mounting cost of medical care for diet-related illnesses, institutionalization and loss of full productive potential, all of these place a heavy economic burden on a society as a whole.
It was an era in which the nation began focusing on a painful fact that 1 in 8 Americans suffered from hunger. In the Senate, George McGovern of South Dakota established the Select Committee on Nutrition and Human Needs, which he would chair for 8 sometimes very stormy years.
We decided after some deliberation on the committee to move ahead on an investigation of the American diet as a whole. What is the great mass of the American people eating? Do we have a good diet in America? And what we discovered was that there was a major flaw in the American diet, and that we weren't going to get on top of the health problems in this country until we began to take a more critical and realistic look at what Americans were eating and in what quantities.
Are you not telling us, in effect, that bad eating habits is a more important cause of cancers, based on the present evidence, than cigarette smoking?
For males, they're probably equivalent.
Dr. Gio Giori of the National Cancer Institute.
For females, you're very right, say. The dietary component in cancer causation is far more important than anything else. The fact is that females smoke less than males. That's the only thing that allows us to make that statement.
It was very persuasive. There were long and carefully done scientific studies of the relationship between the high-fat, high-cholesterol, high-sugar diet and the incidence of heart disease, of strokes, of diabetes, and of other major health problems.
The committee, which included such prominent senators as Hubert Humphrey, Edward Kennedy, and Robert Dole, heard evidence that many Americans dangerously overeat and often consume too many high-risk foods. Dr. Mark Hegstead of Harvard testified.
I'd like to suggest that the prudent diet for Americans is that we should eat less food, we should eat less meat, we should eat less fat, particularly saturated fat, we should eat less cholesterol, we should eat less sugar, we should eat more unsaturated fat, more fruits and vegetables and cereals, particularly whole grain cereals.
The committee issued its findings in January 1977 in a landmark publication entitled Dietary Goals for the United States. Destined to provoke a firestorm of reaction, the report set forth the first major federal statement on risk factors in the American diet.
I think that testimony, which we carefully took from the most respected experts in the field from coast to coast, left no doubt in the minds of anybody on that committee that sat through those hearings that we had a moral and political obligation to let the American public know what the American diet was doing to their health. So we began preaching on that committee, eat less fat, sugar, and salt, and more fruits, vegetables, and whole grain cereals. That was, in a nutshell, what the message was.
This had never happened before.
New York Times nutrition reporter Marion Burrows.
Think about what we're saying. The government's telling you to eat less meat because that's what the original document said. He said, eat less meat. Now we're now talking about the government telling people to stop eating as much of what their own farmers produced as they used to. That never happened before. For years, the Department of Agriculture had been telling to people to eat more meat. You know, don't have an 8-ounce portion of steak, have a 16-ounce portion of steak. Eat lots and lots of cheese and butter and eggs because you will be helping our farmers. And that is our job in life, to help our farmers grow richer and more successful. Now we're telling people to eat less meat, eat less fat, all of the things that the farmers are raising. And when the industry realized what was going on, they went rushing to their favorite senators.
That affects the production and the price of the product that we are producing.
Bill McMillan served as a lobbyist for the National Cattlemen's Association and would later be appointed Assistant Secretary of Agriculture during the presidency of Ronald Reagan.
Now, we're not saying, of course, that you should eat 100% meat all the time. You need a balanced diet. You need the vegetables and you need the other things to come along with a balanced diet. But when people make the recommendation to eat less meat, then and they make that from the government, and the general public would consider that to be authoritative, then that is misleading to the general public, and that's been our main complaint.
Feeling especially pinched by the Senate's dietary goals were the egg farmers, whose product was increasingly linked with high blood cholesterol. The poultry industry stood to lose 24,000 jobs, according to the calculation of Norman Heck, an egg farmer from rural New York.
I believe that this committee has in its power the ability to do America's egg producers, but even more importantly, America's poor, a great injustice. And I most respectfully urge you to draw back from that unwarranted step.
It isn't that we condemn their products. It's simply that we told people they had to be careful.
Committee Chairman George McGovern.
They've got to exercise some restraint in the consumption of those high-fat, high-cholesterol items. But I remember talking with Senator Dole, a Republican from Kansas, next door to my state, comparing notes with him on the reaction we were getting from livestock producers. It was tough. People on the committee from the sugar-producing states were getting a lot of heat about it. The big dairy states weighed in against us. Even people at the Department of Agriculture questioned some of our findings because, after all, they saw their mission primarily as to represent the farm producers of this country.
The industries rose up to thwart this new government nutrition agenda because it would play a key role in the nation's food choices. The menus served at school lunches and in programs for the poor, the information contained on food labels, the dietary advice given by schools and hospitals, and the kind of nutrition research conducted, all are affected. And the meat, dairy, and egg interests didn't feel they were being portrayed in a very favorable light. NYU Nutrition Chair Marion Nessel.
They were unhappy, and they called for hearings, which they got. They called for congressional intervention, which they got. They called for the heads of the people who were on the committee, which they got some of. And they caused the committee to revise some of its statements. And there were some editorial changes which greatly weakened the dietary advice that was in the report.
In fact, 3 weeks after release of the initial report, it was announced that George McGovern's Nutrition Committee would be abolished within a year as part of a plan to streamline the Senate. And having crossed swords with the food industry, the committee found itself facing another formidable foe. Officially protesting the dietary goals was the American Medical Association, which questioned the evidence and argued that patients should receive dietary instructions individually drawn up by their doctors. Some physicians and scientists challenged the very premise that lowering a heart patient's cholesterol level is beneficial. Dr. Robert Olson of St. Louis University.
I have pleaded in my report and will plead again orally here for more research on the problem before we make announcements to the American public.
Well, I would only argue that senators don't have the luxury that a research scientist does of waiting until every last shred of evidence is in. But when we get the kind of overwhelming consensus that is developed before this committee, it seems to me we have some obligation to share that with the American people.
Were you surprised when the doctors lined up against you?
I was somewhat surprised, particularly since some of their most illustrious members were so strong in support of the report. But there were some members of the American Medical Association who felt that we were too extreme, that we'd gone too far in curtailing. the American diet. I think they were wrong. I thought they were wrong at the time. I'm sure today that they were wrong. And I think most of them have now reversed their position. I don't think you'll find much quarrel with the dietary goals today in the medical profession.
How do you explain the fact that today it would be considered almost a lukewarm statement and yet was enough to practically have you run out of town just 20 years ago?
Well, keep in mind that the medical schools of this country were not teaching nutrition. There wasn't much in the way of nutritional science in the medical schools in the 1970s. That's something that has come in more recent years.
Although I understand, not in a great wave.
That's correct. Even today, there are a good many medical schools that I think still don't pay sufficient attention to nutritional matters. It may seem hard to believe, but even the National Institutes of Health were not giving the attention they should to nutritional factors. I remember a long-running argument I had one day when I was presiding over hearings with regard to nutritional factors at NIH relative to cancer. I kept pressing the experts from NIH on the relationship of high-fat diets to things like breast cancer or to colon cancer. I pressed them on the relationship of high-fat diets to heart disease, to strokes, and to other factors. And I must tell you that in the mid-1970s, there was not an awful lot of attention being given to nutritional factors as a health component at NIH or anywhere else in the medical establishment.
Did you need to schedule a follow-up with the
doctor? I don't. I'm just waiting to see if we can get that booklet.
In cardiology now, we have a great deal of focus on diet and improving diet and monitoring diet and instructing patients about diet.
Dr. Peter Stone co-directs the cardiac unit at Boston's Brigham and Women's Hospital. He's a 1974 graduate of Cornell Medical School in New York.
Certainly the experience that I had in medical school in terms of nutrition was towards nil. It was not considered a major element of medical care per se, other than perhaps with pediatrics and obstetrics to ensure good health for a fetus and for young children.
All right, let me roll up your sleeve. Thank you very much.
What is hurt?
Make a tight fist for me, please. No, only a little pinch.
Oh, okay.
Thank you. All right.
Heart patients come here to the blood lab to have their serum cholesterol levels measured. An attempt to lower cholesterol is now standard practice in treating heart disease, in effect vindicating the 1977 McGovern report. But some conservative doctors were not convinced of the strategy until the recent development of highly potent drugs known as the statins. They can reduce cholesterol levels so low that a strong benefit could be observed.
The perception of the value of cholesterol reduction has had overwhelming momentum in the last 2 to 5 years that it did not have before. Oftentimes, medicine as a field can only progress when the tools become available to document a benefit. The benefit now observed in many clinical studies from cholesterol reduction of that magnitude is now overwhelmingly convincing, whereas the prior experience with the less powerful medications was much less convincing.
And because the new drugs carry side effects and are costly, Dr. Stone's first tack is to encourage the patient to adopt dietary changes.
The general goal is to try to reduce animal fat, particularly red meat, as much as possible, and to use spices to try to add as much zest and interest to the foods instead of the cream sauces that we may all have been used to, and also to use as much salad, fruits, and vegetables as possible, and that's obviously beneficial for everyone.
In contrast to 20 years ago, is the notion of a broad-based recommendation to the public on diet something that most physicians accept today?
I think without a doubt. I think public officials, certainly public medical officials and physicians, are all entirely lined up supporting the idea of improving the diet.
Our society's approach to health is evolving, although most medical schools still do not require a serious study of nutrition. Mainstream healthcare remains primarily focused on high-tech tests, dispensing drugs, and performing surgical procedures. George McGovern.
The whole thrust of American medicine in most of our lives has been on taking care of people who are sick, not keeping people healthy by counseling them on diet and exercise and stress and factors of that kind.
Is that because there's, in effect, no reimbursement for good nutrition?
That may be one of the problems. There's neither financial reimbursement nor high praise. Doctors are honored and glorified for being able to fix us up when we get sick, not for keeping us healthy by the advice they give us before illness sets in.
Advocates of greater attention to the role of diet in maintaining our health saw the 1970s skirmish on Capitol Hill as just one chapter in an ongoing saga. Public and scientific interest in nutrition continued to build with the wide availability of best-selling books and publications like Prevention Magazine. During the administration of President Jimmy Carter, a more pro-consumer USDA joined with the Department of Health and Human Services to issue the first-ever Dietary Guidelines for Americans, a booklet that would achieve mass nationwide distribution upon its release in 1980. Professor Marion Nessel.
The dietary guidelines seemed benign enough. Eat more fruits and vegetables, maintain ideal weight, don't drink too much alcohol, don't eat too much salt and sugar, don't eat too much fat. I mean, they were pretty mild, and even then they were just met with fury by particularly the meat industry, and which was very concerned that eat less fat was a euphemism for eat less meat, which of course it was. And as soon as the Reagan administration came in, the Department of Agriculture needed and HHS had to appoint another committee to look at it.
I must say it's a little uncomfortable when you're not quite sure whether the department's going to support you.
Harvard nutritionist Mark Hegstead joined the USDA as Federal Nutrition Administrator, only to find his position abolished during the first year of President Ronald Reagan's pro-business presidency.
When I was in the Department of Agriculture, we got periodic visits from beef producers and egg producers and hog producers. I remember once I went out to the University of Missouri, give a couple of talks to seminars, and I was told the beef producers went to the president of the university and objected to having me on campus.
Pressure from the producers of animal products was also applied to Marion Nessel, who in the early 80s worked in the office of U.S. Surgeon General Everett Koop. She served as managing editor of the 1988 Surgeon General's Report on Nutrition and Health, a 700-page volume that cited overconsumption of high-fat foods as the nation's chief nutritional problem.
Representatives of the meat industry came in on several occasions to talk about their interests and their concerns that the Surgeon General's report not say eat less meat. And I have to say that I was told up front that the Surgeon General's report would never say eat less meat. It might say choose lean meats, which is the general euphemism that was used, but it would never say eat less meat.
And why was that the instruction?
It would be more trouble than it was worth, and it would cause the report not to be permitted to come out.
I've been aware of a more sustained and stubborn effort by the meat producers and others through the 1980s and even up to the present time to try to discourage the new nutritional awareness in this country about the dangers of excessive meat consumption.
George McGovern.
I suspect that the efforts of the meat industry to offset these nutritional findings are directly related to the spread of information among the American consumers and their tendency to look more carefully at what they're eating.
You know, I'm not easily annoyed, but I never liked the way the vegetables always fell off between the sirloin on my beef kebabs. I fix that. I don't put vegetables on my beef kebabs. In fact, I believe that's why someone invented salad.
Beef, real food for real people.
In the 1980s, meat producers launched a series of broadcast and print ads to beef up their product's image.
Whatever happened to real food? You know the kind that just tastes real good. Give me a steak and I won't be booed. I gotta taste for some real food.
Beef, real food for real people.
The Beef Gives Strength campaign, a concept disputed by some consumer groups, was intended by industry to counter the wide perception that beef carries a health risk. Pork producers adopted the slogan, "The Other White Meat," in an effort to distance their product from red meat.
We've just loaded out a trailer load of hogs. They're weighing about 250 pounds, and 200 head of them headed for slaughter. A lot of problems, though, when you have weather problems like this, just getting the hogs fed.
Hog farmer John Block reads his weekly radio commentary about farming and politics. For 5 years, he served as President Reagan's agriculture secretary under a pledge to be a strong advocate for the agriculture industry. Today, as a Washington lobbyist for the food industry, he's still cautious about the dietary guidelines.
I won't say they're inappropriate, but I think that in some ways, some of the efforts over time have been influenced by vegetarians that would rather you didn't eat anything, or animal rights activists that would rather that animal protein was not in our diet. That's my problem with it. But the whole point is that I think common sense people don't advocate eating a lot of fat. We know it's not the best thing to overdose on fat, but yet you can eat a certain amount of fat. You can eat a certain amount of fruit. We need fruits and vegetables and grains of all kinds. Eat some of everything. You'll be all right if you do it that way. That's as good as you can do.
In the 70s, when the McGovern report said that fatty meats can increase the risk of heart disease, the meat industry said, no way, it's not true, the science is lousy.
Bonnie Liebman of the Center for Science in the Public Interest.
Over the years, the response became, fat is bad, but our meat is lean. And that's pretty much the prevailing response we still get from the meat industry.
Is that valid?
Some meats have gotten leaner, and if you trim meat and you know which ones to pick, you can get less fat than you used to. But the fact remains that the most commonly eaten form of meat is hamburgers, and hamburgers cannot be trimmed, and most of them are fatty, and the average person still gets far too much saturated fat from beef. And there is a growing body of evidence that even lean meat may increase the risk of prostate and colon cancers.
There is no way that production agriculture people are going to trust these critics very much, because they've come out over time with so many recommendations that have proven to be just so much nonsense.
Former Agriculture Secretary John Block.
They were the fad of the day. I mean, they tacked butter, and they were promoting margarine. Now, that's one example. And the other one about the nitrosamines and bacon, like they're going to, after you fry it, they're coming out and get you by the throat. And people out in the country are saying, well, what are we to believe? And I think if you go ask the common person on the street, I think they'll tell you that they have been whipsawed back and forth on a lot of nutritional recommendations, and they don't trust much of anything anymore.
I think public confusion is really unfortunate, and partly it's in the food industry's best interest to have the public really confused. But in fact, dietary recommendations have not changed.
Professor Marion Nessel.
Ansel Keys and his wife published dietary recommendations in 1959 that are identical to the 1995 dietary guidelines. And these are food-based recommendations, which are to eat more fruits and vegetables, to choose lean meats and low-fat dairy products, and eat less meat and dairy compared to the overall caloric intake. Don't drink too much. Don't eat too many processed foods. Don't gain too much weight. Get some exercise. All of those sort of basic, simple principles have been identical since the first recommendations on chronic disease risk. They've never changed.
What has changed profoundly is an appreciation by medical experts of just how health-giving fruits and vegetables can be. Bright orange carrots, fresh green spinach, and ripe golden bananas are a treat to the eye. And scientists have found a significant link between eating a lot of fruits and veggies and good health.
It is very, very strong.
Physician Tim Byers was nutrition chief at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention.
Not only here in the U.S., but around the world, that consistently point to a fairly powerful effect of fruits and vegetables on health that benefits lower cancer risk, lower risk of becoming diabetic, lower risk of heart disease, lower risk of obesity. But in my particular interests are cancer, and I find it very compelling that high fruit and vegetable diets protect substantially, not absolutely, but substantially lower risk for many different cancers. In fact, there have been expert panels that have looked at this, and they argue over, is vitamin C important? Is beta carotene important? Is vitamin E important? And constant arguments at that level. But when it comes down to the level of foods and diets high in fruits and vegetables, all the hands go up, and there's consensus that there's compelling, consistent evidence on that.
Now, are we talking about good nutrition, the way we've all heard, to make sure that you get a balanced diet? Or is the protective effect from fruits and vegetables something different from that?
I think it's something different, which is not to say that a balanced diet is a bad idea, because it certainly is a good idea to eat low-fat foods and to balance your caloric intake with physical activity so you don't become overweight. But the effect of fruits and vegetables appears to be powerful enough that even amongst people who are overweight, even amongst people who do eat high-fat diets, even amongst people, in fact, who smoke cigarettes, which is one of the worst things we can do to our bodies, the fruit and vegetable effect is strong enough that we still see it there.
That's the basis for the five-a-day recommendation, to eat at least 5 servings of fruits or vegetables each day, a serving usually being about half a cup. Bonnie Liebman of the Center for Science in the Public Interest.
It's a great nutritional recommendation. One of its strengths is that it's very simple to understand. It's not percentage of calories. It's not milligrams. Anybody can count to 5, and anybody knows what a fruit or vegetable is. It also is not controversial because it's a positive message. There is no food industry that's going to oppose advice to eat more of something.
The five-a-day concept, now adopted federally, was first established in California. Susan Forster in Sacramento is the state's chief of nutrition and cancer prevention.
Our bodies are constantly being bombarded with substances in the environment that can make the cells begin to multiply and go out of control. What fruits and vegetables do is they can block exposure to cells of those carcinogens in the first place, by combining with that carcinogen and helping the body to get rid of it so that the cell isn't even exposed to it. They can also promote healthy cell growth, which is where vitamin A comes in, so that the cell sets up a protective membrane so that the carcinogen doesn't even go inside the cell.
The recent explosion of scientific research into the healthy properties of common fruits and vegetables confirms the age-old common-sense advice to make sure we get enough of these natural foods. But it's the kind of common sense for which we don't get enough support in today's world.
I see some segment of the public, perhaps 10 or 20%, eating more healthfully, you know, learning about nutrition and changing their diet, and that becomes part of life. Most people aren't that way and eat kind of whatever is pushed to them.
Michael Jacobson.
This country is a tough one in which to eat healthfully. We don't eat 3 square meals at home anymore. Kids are bombarded with fast food advertising, McDonald's hamburgers, Burger King French fries, those kinds of foods. Then their parents bring them toys, and maybe it's a McDonald's kitchen set from Toys R Us. Pizza Hut and Taco Bell are in thousands of school cafeterias now. You go out for a drive with the family, and it's a fast food restaurant at every street corner in the city and every stop along the turnpikes there. So it's kind of wherever you go, airports, walking down the street, shopping centers. We're being encouraged to eat, eat, eat. And most of it is junk. And we're responding, you know, logically. You know, they say, eat food, tastes good, okay, I'll eat it. And we're getting fatter. We're eating a junky diet. We're encouraging kids to eat a junky diet. And there's very, very little encouragement from the other direction. You know, pathetically little.
And one final note. Attempts by industry to mold the government's nutrition message surfaced again during the presidency of George Bush. The Food Guide Pyramid was withdrawn in 1991 by USDA Secretary Edward Madigan under intense pressure from meat producers. A year later, because the incident was spotlighted by major media, the pyramid was in fact reinstated, plainly depicting the health recommendation to choose most of our foods from plant sources. Senator McGovern.
I think, as often happens with a new idea like this, there's fear, there's resistance, there's economic anxiety, and eventually the logic and the weight of the truth overcomes that. And today, I think most Americans are more careful about the diet than they were 20 years ago.
You've been listening to The Vegetable Chronicles with host David Freudberg. This program written and produced by David Freudberg with Lisa Mullins. If you'd like to purchase our series on audio cassette, please call 1-800-5-LISTEN. We'll repeat that number in a moment. Our recording engineer is Steve Colby. Special thanks to Tony Buck, Dr. Joan Gusso, Sarah Land, Dan Grossman, Andy Lancet, Michael Dolan, Catherine Carapetian, National Public Radio, and Herb Doris. Theme music adapted by Jim Richards. Again, to order cassettes of The Vegetable Chronicles, call 1-800-5-LISTEN. That's 1-800-5-LISTEN. This program is presented by Far Reaching Communications. Thanks very much for listening. Funds for this Public Radio International program were provided by a grant from the National Cancer Institute.
PRI, Public Radio International.